This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. San Antonio leads the nation in economic inequality, and many of the issues contributing to the opportunity gap is a direct result of the education gap. Texas school districts rely heavily on local property taxes for funding. This is a problem because property values and tax revenues vary by neighborhood and by school districts. The Supreme Court case challenging that is San Antonio Independent School District v. Rodriguez, and it failed at the national level back in 1973. But at the state level, school finance continues to be a topic that plagues policymakers every session of the Texas legislature. How have schools in San Antonio and the rest of the state changed since the Supreme Court's decision in 1973? Should education be a right protected by the U.S. Constitution? Where are we in Texas with school finance and the Robin Hood plan? Give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're joined this afternoon with State Representative Diego Bernal. He represents District 123, and he's the Vice Chairman of the House Committee on Public Education. Also with us is Matt Worthington. He is with Folo Media, and he's doing deep, thoughtful reporting about public education in San Antonio and across the state and the state of funding these schools. And also with us is Mohammed Choudhury. He is the Chief Innovative Officer for the San Antonio Independent School District. And you're invited into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Call in, tell us what you think about school finance and the Robin Hood plan, and what we can, and where you feel, what you think's happening with school funding equity, you know, equality. 210-614-8980, and you can email us at thesource@tpr.org. And great to have you here.
Thank you.
To have you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Representative Bernal, there was some action on school finance in a recent special legislative session.
Right.
What happened?
Well, not much. In the 85th session, we had a HB 21, which was the first step in school finance reform. It would have added $2 billion to the school finance system, and with a number of other improvements, it passed almost unanimously out of the House and then went to the Senate and died. In the special session, there was an effort to revive it, but it became a sort of bastardized version of itself in the Senate and became just a series of grants, and that did pass. I'd voted against it, but you know, as the vice chairman, I had a front row seat to watching a lot of nothing happen, and so in many ways, we find ourselves in close to the same situation we were before the session.
Matt Worthington, what is this Robin Hood plan, or some people call it the Rob the Hood plan for the rich school districts?
I have not heard that latter phrase, but it's commonly known as Robin Hood. It's a 1993 law that was passed. It's formerly called Recapture, and it was designed to equalize funding by requiring wealthy districts, property wealthy, that's a key part of it, to share their funding with districts who could not access additional revenues because they were property poor.
And so we have this recapture, that's the other thing they call it. Does this work?
Well, everybody has issues, not necessarily with Robin Hood or recapture itself, the idea of it, but there are a lot of concerns around loopholes to the system that seem to impact both property wealthy districts and property poor districts in different ways. And because of that, there's a lot of concern that it has not achieved what it's intended to do and what everybody seems to be a fan of.
So, Mohammed, at San Antonio ISD, you're a what? Property rich, property poor school district?
We are a property poor district. My previous district, where I came from, Dallas ISD, definitely a property rich district.
So now you're on the other end of the recapture.
Yes.
What is your mission in regards to trying to deal with school finance and bring quality education to your students?
So our number one mission is to provide the highest quality education to the students we serve. We serve a median income. Our footprint is 30,000. That's the median income of our footprint. We are 93% high poverty district, and we are committed to making high poverty schools work well, and we will continue to do that. And so one of my challenges and tasks has been how do we take the resources that we get and have, the little that we do have, and better allocate that in smarter and better, faster ways. And we've done a wide variety of things, one of which is being able to incentivize our best teachers to be in front of the kids who need them the most. So that's our Master Teacher Initiative. We've also begun to look beyond Title I. I think we limit ourselves as a state, as a district, as well as in the halls of Austin by just saying, like, a Title I school is a poor school. Need is much more than Title I, and we began doing that with something called socioeconomic blocks.
So Dallas ISD is an interesting school district because it has areas of high poverty as well as areas of high property value, right?
Yes, north-south divide.
Yeah, and so you have basically inside Dallas ISD, you were able to see what happens when we're able to take those resources that the overall school district generates. I know there's limits on how much, you know, it's kind of ironic that you have really schools that are in high poverty rates in Dallas that are being told you're a property-rich school district.
Absolutely. Well, we have the historic legacy of white flight and a lot of opting out, as well as a lot of private schools and demographic shifts in charter sector growth. And Dallas ISD, when you round up, is a 90% high poverty district. But even if everyone opted in, it would still be in the mid-60s, high 70s. So even with that, we are still committed to, we were, and they still are committed to ensuring that we educate students who are, you know, coming in with a wide variety of set of disadvantages based on their socioeconomic backgrounds.
So Diego Bernal, a state representative of District 123 here in San Antonio, a lot of people say, well, you just can't throw money at this problem of education.
Yeah, I hear that a lot.
So, I mean, that is the playbook for the people who are like...
Right, and I always respond as, show me when we've actually tried that. It's not as if we took all the resources they say they need, threw it at them, and then said, yeah, that didn't work. I think that there's a sort of a literal passing of the buck where people don't want to invest in the education the way we should. I also think it's important to point out that in the past 10 years or so, the state of Texas has divested in education by about a full third. So we're not throwing money at anybody. We're taking money away and then asking them to perform. So it might make a good talking point in front of a certain crowd, but for the most part, it defies reality.
So you mean it's the state has divested, because it used to be the state and the local school district
right.
shared the cost 50-50 to fund the school district.
That's right.
And now it's down to the state is providing 32% of
That's
that
right.
funding, and
right.
it continues to find ways to
there.
Whittle that down.
That's right. So the state is divested down to about 30%, which leaves the local districts to have to raise their property taxes to make up what they're not getting from the state. So it's almost like you're on a treadmill in terms of the quality of education, but people are feeling the squeeze more. That's the problem we have. People say, my taxes are going up. I'm paying more and more to the schools. I don't see anything happening. And the reason is because the districts are having to raise taxes to make up for what they're not getting from the state. That only exacerbates the innate inequality we have. It makes it worse. So there's not a lot to talk about in terms of what good we're doing. You hear innovations from the district level trying to do the very best they can, but it's safe to say that the state is abdicating its responsibilities. And I don't think anyone else here would disagree with that.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll find out if they do disagree with that or anything else. We'll hear more about how the state funds schools across the state, what's happening with school finance, why this is impacting your property taxes the way that it is. What are golden pennies, and do you really need to know that? The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Source continues after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about school finance and why it matters, not just to your tax bill, but also to the quality of education that we have here in Texas and across the state, particularly for areas that we consider to be property poor. How do we ensure that all kids in Texas have access to a quality education? What does this mean for the workforce and the future of the state? By robbing our public school system, is Texas robbing itself of its future as an economic powerhouse? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. So Matt Worthington, with Follow Media, followmedia.org. You're on the web. You're here in San Antonio writing. The organization is a nonprofit journalism project doing deep reporting about economic inequality here locally and across the state. We talk about golden pennies. This is how we talk about this thing, and people are just going to like go to sleep when we talk about this, okay? This is admit that. But this shows you how kind of complicated and how quickly you get into the woods about this. So what are golden pennies?
Yes. So after the recapture law was passed in 1993, there were policies put in place to help districts transition to less funding. And some of those got put into permanence, even though they were supposed to be temporary. And over time, there was a situation that developed where all districts, poor and rich, felt like they did not have control over their tax rates because so many of them were at the maximum allowed tax rate that the state allows districts to tax their residents. And so to offer those districts relief, they cut property taxes by a third. And they said, look, after this tax rate—
Is that the 2006 HB1?
Yeah. So the compressed tax rates happened in 2006. And what they said was, okay, here's everyone's tax rates. If you decide to raise them, then the first six pennies that you raise them will give you that money with no obligation. So the six pennies that you increase, so voters go to the voting box and they say, we approve this tax rate by one penny of an increase, right? Well, each penny yields a certain amount of money for districts across the state. And what they said was, we're going to guarantee that everybody at least gets the amount of money that Austin ISD gets. Now, that might be confusing, but Austin ISD is a very wealthy district. And so that was a way to try and make things fairer for districts.
Right. So let's go back to that. In 2006, Diego Bernal, state representative, District 123, they had this much ballyhooed, we're going to cut property taxes, school property taxes by a third. And then the state said, we're going to hold school districts harmless. We'll make up the lost revenue.
Right.
But aren't we seeing now that the state is kind of falling short of that promise?
I think the state's falling short of every promise it's made to public education. I mean, we can talk about pennies, we can talk about 2006, we can talk about 1986 when we did the weights. I don't think there's one moment where you can point to the state and say, you guys have done a really good job on this with regard to education. There might be a moment or two, but for the most part, there isn't. So what we have is a built-in innate inequality because we're focusing it on property taxes. And despite that, we have found ways to still reward property wealthy districts and punish districts that don't have a lot of money. Even in the way that we try to transfer that money or spread it around, we still leave so much inequality there that we're not creating real parity. And I think that's why you have folks like Mohammed, who's been brought in by the district to say, look, we really can't count on the state to solve this problem for us. We've got to be innovative ourselves, and let's come up with something else.
So Mohammed Choudhury, Chief Innovative Officer for the San Antonio Independent School District, you've done research looking at how this is impacting the actual education opportunities and outcomes in the area?
Absolutely. So one of the things that I do want to push on is I do think we need to have a conversation about what is adequate funding versus an equity-based funding formula. I think if you look at from the 70s and 80s, there's been a shift ever since the Kentucky case to an adequacy-based question, right? There's been this whole movement around standards and accountability, telling schools that if you don't meet these standards, you will suffer. Well, that puts legislators in a tough spot, and I think there's been successful court cases throughout the nation since Kentucky asking and challenging legislators, what does it take to provide an adequate education for students who come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds, students with who are English language learners, et cetera. I would also push on that to start looking at the places our kids are growing up in. San Antonio ISD specifically, our footprint, is one of the most economically segregated areas in the country. And so what I've decided to do is look beyond Title I and look at the blocks, the census blocks that kids are growing up in, and look at our resources and how we can divert more resources to actual neighborhoods that need an extra counselor, actual neighborhoods that need additional funding, actual neighborhoods that have a disproportionate number of ELL students who need extra programs and services. We don't do that. Often we say, they're all 90% Title I, let's just equally give them funding, and that's equity. Equality is not equity.
There's a vicious cycle about having schools that are not, what some would say are high quality and continuing to be property poor. So if people want to move into areas that they know have great schools. And so we're seeing a crunch in these areas that people want to move into these other school districts, and they don't want to come in these other ones because they're afraid what's going to mean for their students. How does that impact SAISD?
Absolutely. If you look at our footprint, and we are surrounded by 17 different school districts. I am born and raised from Los Angeles Unified. It's a big school district. Dallas, it's a big school district. But in San Antonio, 17 different school districts represent the city. That is unhealthy, but that is what we have. And so the way it impacts our city is disinvestment. Right, we have lost our middle class, and thereby we've lost a lot of social capital with it as well. So we are constantly advocating for our students who come from one of the most abject forms of poverty in terms of the neighborhoods and schools that they grow up in.
Okay, let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980, if you want to join our conversation as we talk about school finance in Texas and here in San Antonio. James is on the line. James, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, sir. I actually do have a question where I'm an aspiring entrepreneur, but I've been thinking about this issue a lot, and I was curious, have we ever thought about developing a program where we incentivize corporations partnering with school districts where they donate, or at least they dedicate a certain portion of their profits every year to the school districts to help, you know, to break down this whole, where there's low funding and low budget coming into these school districts. Also, as a secondary effect, this would actually incentivize corporations to bring their business to Texas, improving the economy of the local environments.
All right, James, thank you for that call. So, Mohammed, can you react to that?
So
I think we have that. We call that taxes.
We call that taxes, right? And so, I mean, I'm from California, so the corporate tax structure is not as nice than Texas. So I would say in California, there is a funding mechanism that takes corporate taxes and plugs it back into education. California has reformed its finance system. It's called the local control funding formula. I don't know personally in Texas what that looks like, especially in a place where we lack state income taxes, as well as the corporate tax structure is more friendlier to business, and what that actually looks like and plugs back into education. So I'll defer to
Diego. Yeah, and so Representative Bernal, the Texas Association of Business, has been very vocal in saying we need better schools.
Right.
Are they as equally vocal in saying we're ready to pay for them?
not really, but I think that the way I look at it is, you have to make sure you don't put in place policies that leave kids out. So what the gentleman who called in is talking about makes some sense for some areas. It won't work in others. I do think, however, that there has to be a way to get the people who depend on the talent we're producing to pay into it another way or a different way. My response would be, as long as it's not a one-off, like a relationship between one district and some companies, we have to think about every kid in Texas, and that really is the challenge. But I do think that the tax structure in Texas lets some people off the hook, and then they turn around and complain about who they don't have coming to work for them.
But he brings up the point that we need to find new sources of revenue.
We do.
And so Matt Worthington at Fullo Media, are there sources of revenue that other states have tapped into that Texas could probably find?
Well, it was mentioned just a minute ago about how Texas does not have a state income tax. There are different types of taxes that can be employed to generate revenue, and some states use them, as Mohammed pointed out. But Texas has had a difficult time in its history agreeing on even at times having conversations about what additional revenues or alternative revenues could be factored into funding schools.
And so, Diego Bernal.
I just want to jump in real quick and point out that it's not just additional sources of revenue that we need. We actually have some dedicated sources of revenue that instead of supplying more money to schools, the state uses that money to supplant it. So in other words, if the lottery produces X amount of dollars, instead of putting that in on top of what's already there, they then take that same amount out and use it for something else. So in many ways, this is a question not just of additional revenue, but of the political will to make sure that we're funding schools in the priority that they should be.
So, like, the lottery kicks in about $1.2 billion per biennium. And so rather than, you know, making that extra, they cut back their other funding so
Absolutely.
That we remain at the same. Other states have turned to cannabis for funding of schools. The gas tax, we have a 5-cent gas tax in Texas that funds schools, but that has been static for decades.
That's right.
It needs to be scaled. And people are buying actually less gas now that cars are getting better. So, more money would be, you know, at least a start, right?
I think more money is a start, but I also just want to point out that when we're doing budgeting in Austin, it's really a series of priorities. It's not that there's this set pie and we're all fighting over the same size pieces. We're making decisions about what is and isn't more important. And so as we continue to give tax breaks to people who don't need it, we could be using that money and funding education to a greater degree than we are.
All right, so Diego Bernal, Democrat, District 123. I'm going to throw this at you.
Great.
There are some people that say that the war on public education coming from the state leaders like Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor, and others that we've had is directly tied to the fact that teachers and school and teachers associations have typically supported Democrats, and that by cutting schools and cutting teachers, and this is an attack on a funding base for the Democratic Party.
You know, I've heard that. Let me just make something very clear. I'm a Democrat in Texas. I'm outnumbered 2-1. I don't know how much power they think I have. They're also talking about the influence of a union in the state of Texas, which has decimated unions, and when unions really aren't as strong as they used to be. I really think that this is just a talking point for them to stay in office. It's easy to demonize people, especially people who don't have a lot of power. But I don't know if it has anything to do with Democrats and has more to do with them just creating an issue so they can stay in office. But it is absolutely disingenuous, for sure.
So, Mohammed Chaudhry at SAISD, how much information do we have, the data, about what student needs are?
We have tons of data.
Is it being used?
Absolutely. Ever since Superintendent Martinez arrived, we have really shifted to being a data-driven system. But even just being better about, again, going back to what we have and how we allocate it across our 90 schools, rather than saying they all get the same amount of shares because they're all 90% Title I. We've moved beyond that. So in terms of data, we're definitely data-driven. Our Master Teacher Initiative is built on teachers who have a track record of success, incentivizing them with our precious tax dollars that our footprint granted us back in 2016 to be able to bring them in front of the most high-needs classrooms and students who need them. So absolutely, we rely on data to make better and smarter decisions.
But can't the data be used to tell a story of tighter narrative that would persuade people and really show them the connections between funding and outcomes?
So I will come back to this question of adequacy. What does it take to raise an army of master teachers? Dallas ISD has one of the best turnaround initiatives in the state of Texas called Accelerating Campus Excellence. It costs money. They are struggling to pass a TRE. It is a model for turnaround. It took 50-plus IR schools and shaved it down to less than 10 in a few years. And so my question is, are we going to do it on the backs of our taxpayers? And then SISD, it's a footprint of 30,000, and they all overwhelmingly supported the vision and mission of Superintendent Martinez under our blueprint plan. So the data
can
show.
Yeah, they supported it at the ballot box.
Yeah, so we can show the data what we're doing. Are we doing more with what we have? Yes, I hope so. But it's going to take a lot more to provide an adequate education to students in high-needs communities.
Okay, we're going to take a break. We got a lot of calls queued up here, and we got a couple of slots. If you want to call in, tell us what you think about what's happening with school finance. We'd love to hear what you have to say or questions or comments. Former teachers, current teachers, how has school finance issues affected you in the classroom? The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Remember, we're talking about school finance, but we're really talking about kids and their futures. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. The source continues after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about school finance today. You're invited into the conversation, 210-614-8980. It's a complicated pretzel that directly impacts you. You're paying the bills. You might have kids in the public school system, but you definitely depend on having a powerful Texas workforce, and that's all depending upon how well we educate our young kids. Let's go to the phone lines. Sarah is on the line. Sarah, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I'm just wondering, particularly with regard to SAISD, what the impact or extent of the impact of charter schools and homeschooling has on the kind of funding available. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you for the call, Sarah. So how has charter schools, it's still pretty minor percentage of the number of kids going to educate in their education that way. Is that right, Mohammed?
Agreed. So, you know, has our enrollment declined over the years? Yes. But, you know, to just point to one quote-unquote villain that is charter schools, I think is wrong. When you look at SISD, 17 different school districts make up that city that I can trace back to 1930s redlining. And we lost the socioeconomic lottery when it was drawn. I can track attendance zones back to these redlining patterns. Coupled with that, demographic shifts, right? Neighborhoods where people can opt out easily, private schools, charter schools, as well as the booming suburbs around us. Also, we have to do better as well, too. It's not just their doing. It's also our doing to do better by our children.
But SAISD is doing things like almost like charter schools. You have the Young Women's Academy.
Yes. So I'm going to, as a former educator who has been in amazing schools, has also worked to turn around a school, we're not doing things like charter schools. We're doing things that we know that amazing educators do.
I mean, that's the number one school in San Antonio.
That is the number one school in San Antonio. It is a selective admission school, so we are picking the most elite.
And it's college preparatory.
It is. But I would say the running thread amongst great schools is empowered educators and giving them control over resources to be able to teach the communities that they serve well. And so we are doing that. Our theory of action is around empowering educators with more resources and having control over the kind of academic instruction they can provide.
And so Matt Worthington at Folo Media, where do you see charter schools fitting into the mix with economic, with education equality?
I think that if you care about education, you care about good schools for children. And that's a first and foremost value that you have to have. At the same time, you also have to think about what's the best way to do that. I think that there's a conversation that educators have about what is possible. And I think there's a question here, particularly around the question of school finance and the distribution and allocation of resources that says, hey, what is scalable?
Okay, another caller, Arthur. Arthur, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
How you doing? Hey, my question is this. You know, I come from a poor neighborhood. My mom raised 11 kids by herself. And out of all of them, 9 of us are homeowners. We pay taxes at school. Where is the money or where are the calls to the parents to get involved? If my mom can do it in a poor neighborhood and her kids, 4 of them graduate from college, all of them have great jobs. They've been at the same jobs for years. If it's not right at home, it's not going to be. You could put all the money you want in school and it's not going to be right for them in school.
All right, Arthur, and it sounds like you had an awesome mom, and that's probably part of the equation there. Not everyone can have such a fantastic mom, but Representative Diego Bernal.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some people have amazing parents that double down, and some people have parents who went to the same school as they're going to, and they didn't really have a lot of opportunity. One thing is schools take students as they get them. The other thing is that achievement in Texas and funding tracks poverty, and so I guess I can't bring myself to say that as the achievements lowers because they have all these kids in these areas don't have good parents and all the kids who are in the wealthier areas have great parents. I think there's something else there. Parents absolutely matter. As a new parent, I agree they matter. But at the same time, there are all of these inequalities that make it harder to do as well. And that's what we have to fix because whether we like it or not, we take kids as they come.
And one of the things
Matt Worthington?
Yeah. One of the things that came up in our reporting was this question. And, you know, Kevin Brown, who is the superintendent of Alamo Heights, he told us that, look, He was a former teacher and school leader in Title I schools, and he said, it's no question in my mind that kids who come from low-income backgrounds, that they have unique challenges and needs that don't often get met by the limited funding sources that are available. So I think it's an important factor, and I do recognize the caller's concern. Good parenting is definitely important, but there is also an expressed concern from our reporting that funding and the distribution, again, the distribution allocation of resources is a critical factor.
Okay, Bruce is on the line. Bruce, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Okay, as I tuned in, I think you all mentioned what seems to me to be the ultimate solution to this problem, and that is the excess number of school districts in San Antonio. What would it take to consolidate all of this into one district? Edgewood gone, South Sand gone, Alamo Heights at the opposite end of the spectrum, gone. You know, merge it all into Northside, keep the best administrators, and, you know, you can imagine how the efficiency with all of these levels of bureaucracy, how the efficiency could be increased. And this would also be sweet revenge for Rodriguez v. San Antonio. And so I was a vendor back in the day to Northside, to the information services department for Northside. And what I saw was there was tremendous waste.
Okay, Bruce, we got that. Thank you so much. So we have all these school districts, and we know for a fact that the reason why we have so many school districts was because of economic discrimination here in San Antonio. So, Mohammed, how is that true?
Yes. I mean, you can track that back. Christine Drennan of Trinity University has done that research. You can track it back how these ISD lines have been drawn. In Dallas, Highland Park ISD is right in the middle. There's a reason. That is all intentional. There's nothing natural about our neighborhoods. They're planned, designed, and upheld. It's a third rail issue. People talk about consolidation efficiencies, but who will have the courage to take it? And this is both people who are red and blue progressives continue to uphold decisions that maintain the segregation, right? And so that's very important to note. I think open enrollment opportunities allow for you to disrupt those lines.
So that means if you live in one school district, you should be able to go to another school district?
Yes. So we've launched, we have our own homegrown school choice initiative that has opened up our boundaries that allow for more socioeconomic diversity and integration in specific schools. And we know those are optimal learning environments.
So kids from Southside can go to SAISD,
absolutely.
But Southside, they're losing kids. And so that's hurting their economic viability. What happens to the kids who don't have those transportation options?
So we provide transportation in our school district because choice without transportation is not choice. However, yes, this is the game that we're all put in, right? We're all fighting.
Are you
for
poaching those kids in order to get that extra state funding?
I'm not poaching the kids, but I've opened up the our enrollment to allow for out-of-district students that same access as well with certain guardrails and control set-asides put in.
And they're getting better education for it?
Yes.
Diego Bernal, consolidating school districts, you have to have votes.
Right.
This is going to take an election for both those little school districts,
sure,
to say we want to unite. Or you could have a school district go belly up and the state that says we're going to dissolve you and combine you with another one. That could happen here. We've got a lot of school districts in trouble.
It could.
And they could be forced to consolidate with Northside.
It's certainly possible. I want to point out, you said something earlier, that the school districts and the lines that they adhere to, that is certainly part of economic segregation, but it also in large part racial segregation. The fact that we're still operating in a system where we have these 17 school districts, we should in some ways be ashamed that we've stuck to that. Now, I'm not saying the answer is one school district or four, but I do think that we have to acknowledge that this system, this number, this count isn't healthy, and it harkens back to a day that we thought that we left behind. But let me add one point, though. I don't think that it's just the number of districts, because you can go to other cities that have one large district and they have the same problem. I think the issue, the major issue, is that since we've settled on this form of school finance in the 80s, at that time, the number of poor kids and the way that we measure poor kids was about 27, 26%. Since that time, the number of poor kids in Texas has gone up to about 62%. The average student now is poor. The middle class and upper class kid, they are the special populations, and we have not adjusted to that new reality. That, to me, is the biggest issue.
And we're focusing on San Antonio School District. This is really a statewide problem, and right. There are a lot of really poor rural school
Absolutely.
Districts. They don't have anyone to consolidate with that's going to solve any problems for them.
And if they do, they're miles and miles apart, which makes the problems worse. That's what I'm saying. But those districts are experiencing poverty as well, and we're still operating in a school finance system that acts like the middle-class kid is the average kid, and they're not.
So Matt Worthington from Follow Media, have y'all looked at whether or not consolidation would solve anything?
Yeah, this issue goes back to the 20s, you know, when the state superintendent of education wrote about the need for consolidation because there were thousands of school districts. I think it was around 5,000 school districts. At that time, they had sort of said, let's put a plan together. And in the 30s, they recommended consolidation plans. For San Antonio and Bexar County, it was about 4 or 5 or 6 districts that were supposed to be consolidated. That's what the state recommended. But also during that time, and this is what Diego was referencing, is that it was legal to discriminate. And Edgewood, when districts were largely consolidated, nobody wanted to include Edgewood in consolidation because of its property poor values that had resulted from the consequence of racial and economic segregation.
One thing about having so many school districts, it's very difficult to cover that for the media. So these other small school districts can do so much and kind of operate out of the spotlight. But TPR just hired a new education reporter, and she's going to be on the beat. And we're going to be taking a special look at all the San Antonio education. We're dedicated to that. That was something our listeners wanted. Okay, our caller, we're going to continue with callers. When we come back from the break, the source continues after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. School districts in property-poor areas need more resources. Taxpayers in property-rich areas deserve a break, but they also have to have a say in how their tax money is being spent. The bottom line, Texas needs quality public education available to all. We're talking about that this afternoon. You're invited into the conversation. The number is 210-614-8980. And Sandy has called in. And Sandy, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, and hello to all your panelists. I am a 36-year employee of SAISD and a product of SAISD, so I feel like I have a little stake in this. I do recognize the fact that I see myself as a progressive, but I'm also open to other Republican candidates that seem to be more qualified on certain races. But in this respect, I see a pattern, and I don't know if I'm the only one or maybe it's just me, but there seems to be a coordinated effort on the far off the cliff right to deny education. I see it in the budget that's currently being proposed on the national level. There's cuts to Head Start, which is a program I feel you get a lot of bang for your buck if implemented correctly, and we have it in San Antonio. Pell Grants, you know, just diminished almost to the point of being abolished. No tax credits for teachers that pay money out of their pocket. I think it's an effort, I mean, frankly, to keep people uneducated and uninformed so that people on the far, far right can say, you see, it's those big city mayors that are all Democrats that are taking your tax dollars and all they know how to do is raise your taxes. So I'd like to.
All right, Sandy, thank you for the call. We got a lot of callers here. So I'm going to go first to Diego Bernal, representative from District 123.
First, Sandy, you're not the only one who thinks that. That is absolutely what's happening. As we mentioned before, the state of Texas has divested over a third, over 30% in the public schools over the past 10 years. And then at the same time, the people responsible for those cuts are saying, look at how they're failing. And I always say to people, you can't be both the arsonist and the fire marshal, right? So they're trying to create a situation where schools are having a harder time and then they push alternatives. You're absolutely right. There is a very strange subterranean war on public ed. I'm not sure what drives it, but I don't know if it's a partisan thing or if it's just let's stay elected thing, but you are right.
Does it have to do with, we know what the racial back makeup is of the children who are in public education in Texas. So, Mohammed from SAISD, what does that break down to?
So we are a high minority, high poverty school district, disproportionately Latino. And then our English language learner population is about 20%. I actually think it's higher, but San Antonio has had a history of, you know, not claiming bilingualism as an asset, but we are shifting towards that as we launch more dual language programs. As well, and then the rest of the district is broken down by blacks, and then our white population is barely there. And then, of course, we are a 93% Title I district. So that's
and statewide, it looks like that Texas's public school population is growing a minority base.
Yes.
Okay, another caller, and this is Rhoda. Rhoda, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes. I agree with the people who said that we need to unite the school districts. Anything else is just rude and will not ever get people out of poverty, except the exceptions like the young man you spoke to, who is one of 11 kids. The thing that poor people have to give to their kids is just more poverty unless they get good schooling. Now, I am 77 years old. As such, my tax rate for my house was frozen when I was 70. I am willing to give that back. I'm going on record now saying I don't care about the tax break. I want to contribute to the schools, and more people need to feel this because schooling is essential for growth and a way to get out of poverty. Pre-K, not every child gets to go to pre-K. I have two grandchildren who had been in the foster system, and if they had not, they would have had to go to a private school in order to get pre-K, and it did so much for them. If you want to make them happy, they're 6 and 8 right now, give them a book. I will take my answer off the air.
Rhoda, thank you so much for the call. Representative Diego-Bernal, how often do you hear someone saying that they're willing to pay more taxes to support? But, you know, it seemed like San Antonio versus other communities in the state, they get it when it comes to the system we have now is not sustainable.
Right.
We've got to do something.
So I don't hear it often, and it's really nice that she called to say that. But I will say that as a community, we have demonstrated over and over again that we care about education, that we're willing to prioritize it, that we're willing to pay more. I just think that the people on the other end of that equation need to make sure and come through and provide that.
The other end of the equation, who's that?
That's government.
The state government.
Absolutely.
Okay, now Matt Worthington.
Yeah, the question of are people willing to increase their taxes, when you look at the data of those property poor districts, 40% of them are taxing at the maximum allowed rate. And for the property wealthy districts, only 9%. And so you do see a trend among property poor districts that they are increasing their tax rates, but they also have limits to how much they can increase. And so I think that there is a will there from a lot of districts. But that's a part of the problem, is that they don't have the wealth that can generate the amount of money that's needed.
But there's also a connection between the taxpayer and having faith that their money is going to be used properly spent. And so maybe we have that happening here. I don't know. In other communities, not so. I know I saw Odessa ISD last week. Their bond proposal failed by 60% from voters. And you wonder, why is that happening in other parts of Texas? So let me get one last caller here. This is Tom. Tom, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, David, and panel. Just real quick before I ask my question, did I hear that right? 26% were considered in poverty in the 80s, and now it's 62%?
That's right.
Holy, that should be broadcast all over the place.
I'm trying right now.
That's a phenomenal change. And yeah, I'm like, I would never even thought that. So my question is, are there fast-track programs for people who are like white-collar professionals who want to start up a second career in their 50s, 60s? To kind of fast track themselves into the school districts, you know, maybe like a 3-month, you know, type of fast track to get them integrated within the system, to get them their teacher certificate in order to get them in the place that, you know, these people actually have real world experience and they want to, they have a passion for what they do and they want to pass them on to kids.
All right, Tom, thank you for the call. And so, Diego Bernal, you want to talk about alternative teacher certification? Is that you? Or do you want to talk about Mohammed?
I'll just give the brief answer. The answer to the caller's question is yes, there are. But I'll let Mohammed take the more detailed piece of it. But the answer is yes.
So, you know, can you rephrase the question again? So I'm trying to understand.
So if you, you know, want to become a teacher, you've been out in the world, now you've and now you want to be certified, there are sorts of programs that alternative certification for teachers in Texas. And there are, you know, as you know, the school districts can become school districts of innovation, which allows them to hire a lot of these alternatively certified teachers. And there are a lot of online programs that people can sign up for that they can become alternatively certified teachers.
I'm tired of treating education like a second-class job that is not at the level of lawyers and doctors. Frankly, teachers should be going through residency models, something that we have invested heavily in SISD. We are running residency lab schools where we are trying to generate our own army of high-quality teachers so we can sustainably have a source and literally become teacher town like Long Beach, California has done. These alternative certified programs are great. I think they allow for career changers, which has some of the best teachers that I've met. But at the end of the day, it does not change the experience of what it takes to raise an amazing teacher. And we know from research, being under a master teacher and through a residency model, just like medical school, matters. So just this quick hit, let's put them in. And where do you think those teachers end up? They end up disproportionately in our most disadvantaged communities and school districts, while you can take seniority and track it across wealth. That's how you can do it. And then your most tenured teachers end up gravitating towards the north. In Los Angeles, it was the west side. So that alternative certification is great, but it doesn't replace what it costs to raise a great teacher.
Yeah, and more than half of the schools, teachers in school, public schools, classrooms in Texas are alternatively certified. They haven't really gone through a program. And so Matt Worthington, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, there are a number of programs that people can join, but I did want to highlight that since 1995, the population, the share of students who are identified as economically disadvantaged has actually outpaced the growth of the population of students in Texas. And that number is around 12% increase for students who are identified as economically disadvantaged. And I think that just to the point of the caller, I think there's a lot of people that don't know that and that aren't aware of that. But in our reporting, that was an issue that came up again and again and again, regardless of who we talked to.
So Matt Worthington of Follow Media, what does it take to provide a student in Texas a quality or adequate education?
That question, there's a lot of opinions and there's a lot of studies that have been done about that. But in our state's history, despite our state constitution guaranteeing a public education for the distribution of knowledge, he uses a phrase in various points of adequate, and the state has never passed a law that studies what the phrase adequate means. And because of that, we don't know how much it costs to educate a child in Texas.
And so Representative Diego Bernal passed that law, huh?
Yeah, no problem on it. I think that part of it is when you listen to everyone here and the callers, we're not meeting the students where they're at, right? We're not giving them adequate funding. We're not understanding the issues they bring because they're poor. We're not recognizing that most of the students in Texas schools are poor. We're not recognizing that teaching should be a world-class job. We're treating it like it's some sort of disposable trade. We need to do more.
Right, and there are people who say these kids will teach themselves. There's so much online. A lot of these kids live in neighborhoods where they're not really hooked up. There's no broadband in these areas. That's another problem for another day.
It's the next show.
We got to fix that too. Okay, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks to our guest Matt Worthington, Representative Diego Bernal, Mohammed Choudhury. This is The Source. Thanks for listening.